Hello and welcome to the Beacon Podcast. Beacon is a project of the Maine People's Alliance, and you can subscribe and find past episodes at mainebeacon.com or on iTunes. I'm Mike Tippin, Communications Director for MPA, and with me is Mayor of our hearts, if not yet, of the city of Lewiston, Ben Chen.
Good to be with you, Mike. And you know what? You're certainly the communication director of my heart as well. So
get a room. So we have a lot to talk about today. Unfortunately, we are missing Taryn this week. We also don't have a life advice section, which I think those fit together because she's the one that actually is good at answering those. But we have a ton to talk about, especially because of two of our favorite politicians that have just given us a ton of material here. So we're going to talk about some statements from Governor LePage and also Representative Bruce Poliquin, our representative here in the 2nd District.
As he is likes to declare himself.
Right. So for LePage, I'm sure most people have seen at least some of his remarks over the last week or so, kind of forgetting that he lives in Maine and thinking that this is a southern state that fought for the Confederacy. He continued to do the kind of both sides, attacking the left for the violence in Charlottesville and failing to unilaterally condemn neo-Nazis and KKK and terrorists. But he also got historical a bit here. So my favorite quote of his over the last week was something he said in a radio interview, which of course is the only way he interacts with the media at this point, is friendly radio. And he said, "If you truly read and study the Civil War, it was turned into a battle for the slaves, but initially, I mean, 7,600 Mainers fought for the Confederacy, and they fought because they were concerned about, they were farmers, and they were concerned about their land, their property. It was a property rights issue, as it began. The President of the United States, who was a very brilliant politician, really made it about slavery to a great degree." So, the Civil War being about slavery, that's apparently Abraham Lincoln's spin job there.
Yeah.
Ben, I know you like history. What was the Civil War about, and what role did Maine have?
All right, so many thoughts here. The first thing is, it is just so wrong to say that the Civil War was not about slavery on so many levels. And I hate to even bring some citations and evidence into this because it almost dignifies the argument like you need to. But in case anybody is interested, I actually read a really good book last year called Apostles of Disunion by Charles B. Dew, D-E-W. And, you know, the reason why this book was written, let me step back and say, it is remarkable to me how well-formed LePage's white supremacist worldview is, that he really does have the whole package. It's not just like the anti-immigrant talking points. Yeah. He actually is grounding this in all the bogus historical claims.
Perhaps we should say that first, that is completely false, his claim that there were 7,600 Mainers fighting for the Confederacy.
That's right.
Andy O'Brien, who's a reporter for the Free Press, talked to the state archivist and to other historians, and they could round up about 30 people that had any kind of connection to Maine that fought for the Confederacy. And it's a little hard because the southern states didn't keep the best records. We know, on the other hand, that 80,000 people fought for the Union from Maine. So even on the most generous interpretation of LePage's remarks, he was off by like 25,000% is how far he was wrong on this.
Yeah, right. So, like all LePage statistics, I mean, I don't remember the last LePage statistic I heard that had any real bearing on reality. I think we're within the standard deviation right now of error for LePage statistics. Yeah, so that's a great point, Mike. Totally false. And in addition, like, that just was not the reason Southerners themselves gave for the conflict. So this book, Apostles of Disunion by Charles B. Dew, its primary methodology and source of evidence is there were all these people who were these apostles of disunion that traveled the South as lecturers that were going to generate like grassroots and grass top support in the Confederacy for the Confederacy. This whole project that was like, in many ways, like a very tough sell to go convince people we're going to secede, we're going to initiate the bloodiest war ever in the history of America. You may lose all sorts of things, including your life, if this were to happen. And so, like, what are the core arguments that are given? And so this guy went out and he researched what was in these speeches. And it is just abundantly clear these speeches were about slavery. They were about protecting that political and economic system that was founded on slavery. And in point of fact, if you sort of trace the arc, another good book to recommend, you know, going back to a friend of the pod, Ibram X. Kendi, who won the National Book Award this year around his book Stamped from the Beginning, A History of Racism in America. One of the things that he really shows in that book is that the arguments for slavery got more intense, not less intense, as the Civil War approached.
And we should just note there that 100% of the authors that have appeared on this podcast have gone on to win the National Book Award.
It's viewed as sort of a stepping stone. Yeah, it's like a little bit more prestigious than, say, a Fresh Air, basically. So, you know, on the negative side, like, I think it's important to point that, you know, LePage is just wrong about those facts. Mm-hmm. One thing I'd say on the positive side that, like, is really a shame, and there's like a missed opportunity in this moment around racial justice to really dive into the true history about Maine's role in the Civil War.
Right.
You know, let's just spend 1 minute thinking about the Battle of Gettysburg. And I actually, you know, and props to, I'll do a shout out here to my dad, who is Beacon podcast listener, who I think actually gave you some props over email around your dating advice and how it was about as good of dating advice as an engineer would give, which I think was, he is an engineer. I think that was a little bit of a backhanded
high praise
insult.
Then. All right.
Yeah, exactly. But he does a lot of work with the military, the Air Force in particular, and we actually got a battlefield tour of Gettysburg from a guy who knew us from Maine, and he like took us to the spot in Gettysburg where Joshua Chamberlain and all the soldiers in Maine, you know, were standing their ground, and he just really explained like how essentially like the whole fate of the Union came down in a very serious way to like what this decision of Mainers, like these decisions that Mainers made, where they were out of ammunition and they were protecting the flank of this line of Union soldiers. And if the Confederates had been able to like dislodge them from that position, they would have just wrapped up the whole line of the Union. And then if Lee had been able to charge up to the north, I mean, that really would have been it. And he told the story of this crew of, I think it was like bikers from the south that came up to get the battlefield tour. And they were all flying these Confederate flags. And like, they knew this too. Like they were upfront about like how sad they were that Maine like was there, and how Joshua Chamberlain, night before the battle, had been reviewing like all this history of battlefield tactics. I mean, he really knew down to like the maneuvers that Napoleon did. There were these moments when people out of ammunition charged. And of course, that's what these Mainers did. They had no idea how strong the Confederate forces were below. They fixed bayonets with no ammunition, risked their lives, and many of them, of course, did die. And they charged down the hill to defeat these Confederate soldiers. And they basically assumed they were charging down to their deaths. And it turned out that was exactly the moment that allowed the Confederate troops to break. And it was just like one of these like extremely pivotal moments in history that essentially boiled down to like a bunch of working class people throwing their lot in with the cause of freedom for people of color. And of course, you know, we should say that there's this other critical piece of history where, you know, just the massive amount of slave rebellions that happened in the Civil War disrupted the whole Southern economy. And so in nowhere are we like playing into like a white savior narrative what happened in the Civil War. But this is one of these important moments in American history where white working class people and people of color find common cause.
Right. It's not over property rights.
Exactly.
I mean, except that the property was human beings. And I mean, they marched into battle. They were singing, "As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free." They knew what they were fighting for. I mean, this is just the most amazing insult to that generation of Mainers. And more people from Maine fought in the Civil War by population than any other state in the Union. I mean, we were the founders of the Republican Party, the hotbed of abolitionism and the cradle of the Union Army.
It's absolutely right. And for people looking to like get a very vivid representation of this, the movie Gettysburg, I think you can probably even find this clip on YouTube. Joshua Chamberlain is played by, I forget, oh man, who's the guy who Joshua Chamberlain
is
played
we
by?
Should
maybe,
Google this.
Maybe we should Google it. But probably the best speech in that whole movie of Gettysburg is a speech that Joshua Chamberlain gives. And you know, he's standing up there in front of some folks who are like really tired and very battle weary and wondering whether or not they should go home and kind of tired of all the bloodshed. And he just very simply lays this out, that there has never been in the history of war a war quite like this one, where the whole purpose of it is not to conquer more territory or to get add property rights into this mix. The purpose is freedom. Freedom for a people who are enslaved. And it really, I mean, that is in its essence, like, true. And the other thing I just say about that is, you know, Jacobin magazine had this great, on this anniversary of the Civil War, I forget which one it was, they had a whole issue just dedicated to it. And one of the things that they noted was there are like just two or three movies that exist in America, like all of American film history, that are pro-Union. The vast majority of films that have been made have been either pro-Confederacy or neutral. And so the point that they're making is, even if you look back to like one of the very first films that was ever made, The Birth of a Nation,
right. That's
a film that's like pro-KKK. If you look at Gone with the Wind, you know, that's another one just sort of romanticizing the Confederacy. There's an incredible amount of misinformation out there in our culture about what the Civil War meant. And there's very, very little that is actually telling the true story. And it's just one of these things where it's like, there's a lot of romanticized American history that's out there that's wrong. This is one of the few things that is right.
Right.
And very just like meaningful and even just radically true for our time in terms of how to understand racial justice and building like a multiracial working class coalition for freedom and the well-being of all people.
Chamberlain, in addition to being the namesake for the band that does our theme music, so we embed that history here in the podcast every
week.
That's
right.
He was played by Jeff Daniels.
That's right.
And he won an Oscar for Best Mustache.
Who better to embody the racial justice spirit of Maine than Jeff Daniels, the all-American Jeff Daniels?
Well, I do think you're really hitting on something here. In a book I've been reading recently that I think a lot of people are, it's one of the New York Times bestsellers right now on Steve Bannon, Devil's Bargain. Really well written, but one of the things that Bannon talks about is politics being downstream from culture.
Mm.
And so he was really looking at changing, in an evil way, the culture of the United States that would later affect politics. And he succeeded in that with creating this kind of racial resentment. I mean, not creating it, but emphasizing it that helped to lead to Trump. And I think, you know, we've hit on how you need to fight back on some of this. We need both better education and better culture around this and better entertainment that teaches people about this. So I think, yeah, more movies like Gettysburg, like Glory, another great Civil War movie. People should be ashamed to fly the Confederate flag in Maine. They shouldn't be proud of it. Our history is one of freedom and of fighting against slavery. And we also need better education. I mean, I don't know how well you think your high school education covered these issues, but I think in Maine, we did a good job on the Civil War. But after that, Reconstruction, which is just a hugely important part of our history and kind of planted the seeds for a lot of the racial injustice that occurs right now, completely glossed over. I think the things, and maybe some of this is my fault, I should have studied harder, but the things I most remember are carpetbaggers, scallywags, and from the Grant administration, the thing I remember is the Teapot Dome scandal. not a fight, you know, not all the black people that were elected in the South to Congress, not the
right.
fight for equality and integration, and not the racial terror that put an end to the project of Reconstruction. So maybe there needs to be a mini series on that period too.
Totally agree. And, you know, the very first anti-terrorism law that was ever passed in American history were the Enforcement Acts, directly in response to the creation of the KKK. It is just so bizarre that we live in a world where the discourse on terrorism is somehow governed by the right and directed at people of color, particularly Muslims and people from the Middle East and South Asians, when in reality the root of this whole discourse, like the actual core of it that has like most had directly had a bearing on, you know, American national security from the Civil War through Timothy McVeigh, etc. In Charlottesville is this idea that like we have the longest tradition of terrorism threatening America is a terrorism of white supremacy. And it has literally led to the toppling of democratically elected state governments. And so I think your point is right on. And, you know, in the same way that, you know, we have these like cultural norms that are about supporting the troops and having lapel pin. And these are all sort of symbols right now of believing in our country in a certain way at a certain time. It's just remarkable to me how little is left of how we commemorate the Civil War. You know, and maybe that's just a function of there are no more veterans who are alive that fought in the Civil War. But I feel like if there was just one event in American history that we could better commemorate in whatever context, days off from school, like special assemblies, special days, statues, flags, like whatever, like Civil War and Reconstruction, it would be it.
So I think that's a very interesting point. And we don't have a lot of Confederate monuments in Maine, although apparently we've discovered a couple of plaques, one at a university, one at a church that are being dealt with now, which is great to see. But we do have a lot of Civil War monuments. And it was interesting, you know, growing up, there was a statue of a Civil War soldier in Webster Park in Orono. And when I moved to Westbrook, there was the same statue in the middle of the major park there downtown. And it was actually one that was mass produced. And there are the same statue all over Maine of this Civil War Union soldier. So maybe instead of tearing down Confederate statues, there's something we can do in Maine to honor the Union ones that we have throughout here. So I don't know what that is. Maybe we need to knit some scarves for them for the winter or something, or leave some flowers at your local Civil War pro-Union monument, anti-slavery. But that I feel like monuments, you know, LePage is wrong that they are so important to our history when they are telling the wrong history and they are lionizing the wrong people, but they have meaning. I mean, that's why we're having this conversation, because they matter and we should be talking about them.
A great example of what you're talking about, Mike, is Monument Square in Portland. The monument in Monument Square is a monument to the Mainers who served in the Civil War. And it's interesting to me that I bet like 9 out of 10 people in Portland, here's a LePage statistic, who knows if this is true or not. but I had to look it up to know what the Monument Square in Portland was, even though I've been to rallies there, I mean, all sorts of times. And I remember, you know, at Bates, there was this deliberate conversation that happened around, there was a building that everybody on campus always called the Silo. And the actual name on it was the Benjamin Mays Center. And Benjamin Mays was an African-American and probably the single biggest mentor Martin Luther King Jr. had growing up in his college years. And he graduated from Bates. And so there's this building named after him. And there was a deliberate effort on campus to say, like, we're going to make sure that we stop calling this building the Silo, because it doesn't mean anything. But calling it the Mays Center really does. It's a deliberate way to like commemorate a person and a purpose that life had. So, you know, I just kind of challenge people out there. It's like, what if we came up with a different name for Monument Square in Portland or other kind of similar things, just deliberately went out of our way to call something that was just like a little bit more of an accurate, meaningful representation of what this is purposefully trying to commemorate.
That's a project. We'll keep working on that. Folks listening to this, if you have ideas for ways we can move that forward and reclaim some of this public space and these public names, let us know. The last thing I just want to say on Governor LePage is he also gave a radio address. And so this is a written statement and something that he pre-records that goes out on the radio. And there was a statement in that that had kind of a similar theme of being on the wrong side of history, but a much more contemporary focus. And so he said, the so-called anti-fascists went to Charlottesville looking for a confrontation. It cost the lives of a young woman and two dedicated police officers. Yeah, I mean, let's not forget LePage is historically wrong.
Oh my God.
Also in the present, just blaming the counter-protesters against the Nazis for the violence. He's just an awful guy. And yeah, there's a great cartoon on Beacon this week from Greg, our cartoonist, of him as a Civil War Confederate general as a statue himself. So I felt like that was appropriate. Maine's own racist monument.
I feel like there is some kind of law of nature that stipulates that the bizarro worldview of LePage and Trump's, they first will start off with false equivalency, and then it will move to a complete inversion of reality. Where at the beginning it was like, they're all bad. And then by the end it's like, oh no, actually the real cause was exactly the opposite of, you know, of what is true. I mean, it's just like, it's just crazy that after a certain amount of time, you can just predict. It's like, oh yeah, the protesters, it was like the people who died. It's not just that they were like equally bad as white supremacists. They actually, you know, were the cause of the death themselves somehow. Yeah.
So we should talk about another Maine Republican politician, Representative Bruce Poliquin of the 2nd District. He gave an address, I guess. I mean, I wasn't there. It was a conservative crowd at a cocktail reception for the Maine Heritage Policy Center on Tuesday. Some of my friends were there outside protesting and holding signs. But on the inside, someone recorded his speech and sent it to us, as they often do, and we thank you very much. No matter where you're coming from, we've had all kinds of Republicans and Democrats send us recordings of politicians in Maine, including members of Governor LePage's campaign way back in 2010 when they were trying to trash other people that were running in the Republican primary. I won't say who sent it to us, but just some amazing stuff that Poliquin said here. And it is particularly interesting to me because he is so tight-lipped and careful and never says anything in public or to reporters that isn't, I support veterans and I work hard and I sleep in my office. You know, he refuses to comment even on major issues like the healthcare legislation for weeks and weeks at a time and hides from his constituents and refuses to do town halls. So it's very interesting when you get something like this, and we've had some audio previously of him talking to a conservative organization, he really lets loose and says how he really feels. And there are a few things that I found interesting, but the first one that I wrote about this morning on Beacon, and you can find it at mainbeacon.com, is just throughout the talk, he really went out of his way to attack the Senate, and somewhat obliquely but pretty clearly, Senator Collins as well.
Mm.
So he said, how can anybody not vote to even start debate on the healthcare repeal, which obviously she did, called it shameful. He joked about how we need to pray for our senators and reach out to whoever you think you should. And the crowd, you know, knew exactly who he was talking about. And then he pretty much called her a liar and said, now, for some people to say, well, the reason I can't support this, Bruce, is because it cuts Medicaid. That is a flat out untruthful statement, is what he said. And the person in Maine that has been talking about it cutting Medicaid and the person that might have said that to Bruce is Senator Collins. You know, that has been her vocal line opposing it and what she's gone on TV and said, that these are sweeping and deep cuts to the Medicaid program, and that's what she's most concerned about. And of course, she's right, and all the independent policy experts agree with her, and the American Medical Association and everyone else on the planet except for a few Republican members of Congress. But he is still trotting out that line that those aren't cuts. And then what struck me the most is that the audience obviously hated her, really wanted to see her defeated in a primary, were lobbing insults at her, called her a swamp creature, and he did not push back on anything that they said. He's just like, oh, I hear you, and you know, you should vote in primaries no matter how, which way you feel or whatever. And that is stunning to me because she is someone that endorsed him, that raised money for both of his congressional campaigns, that appeared in ads for him, you know, endorsing him, did press conferences with him. For him to really throw her under the bus like this, I guess no honor among Republicans, and we shouldn't expect too much from Poliquin, but that was a bit stunning to me, even for just a kind of insular conservative audience.
Okay, so I feel like these two things when you put them together, you know, his commentary on Collins and then his like rationalization of trying to like escape Trump and weasel out of like commenting on actual issues and hiding from the press. Mm-hmm. I feel like when you put these two things together, you start to get a very clear sense of this guy's true goals here.
Right.
Because you can sort of have like one theory about like, why does this guy never want to talk to the media about real issues? And like, and why is he like afraid of talking about like what Trump says? Like, why does he never actually comment on those things? One theory is like, oh, he's just doing the politician-y thing,
right,
of wanting it, keep it local and stay out of controversial stuff. And maybe that seems cowardly, but it seems sort of typical maybe in some ways. The other darker idea is that maybe there is like some core part of Poliquin that actually kind of agrees with these terrible things that Trump is saying and doing. And to me, the evidence for why that darker thing, why we might have a little bit more evidence for that, is like a lot of how he talks about Trump is sort of this way of like trying to be deferential to sort of the leader of your party. Mm-hmm. You know, he talks about like, this guy's your nominee. And you sort of have this attitude of like, Poliquin is this like good soldier in his caucus, like just trying to be supportive of the party. And there's like kind of like a team spirit showing a Patriots video, like, like ruse around that. But like, if that were the case, why does he feel no loyalty whatsoever to Senator Collins? Like, mm-hmm. like as you're pointing out, I mean, this person, in terms of the Republican Party in Maine, in terms of just like politicians in Maine, I mean, she's the most popular politician in the state.
Right.
She's certainly the most senior member of the Maine delegation. I mean, the fact that this guy is ranging from just at best kind of like throwing up his hands and like mounting no active defense towards like actively undermining the positions that she has taken with completely absurd, ridiculous lies about substance, what's in the healthcare bill. I mean, to me, this just indicates that he actually has no like real loyalty to the Republican Party itself. Right. It's like this guy's sympathetic to Trump's project. Like that's a real reason why he's not commenting on this, is like he likes the fact that Trump and people like him go out there and they whip folks up to conservative causes using all these like really just terrible things like, you know, abiding by white supremacy, you know, the way that we just talked about. I mean, I gotta
disagree with you. I feel like, well, first of all, Poliquin has no core. But I think if he was in a different situation, he might defend Collins, but he is just does whatever he thinks the situation demands and whatever the audience wants to hear. I mean, he ran the first time for governor as a pro-choice technocrat,
mm-hmm.
you know, and lost to a Tea Party candidate. And so he became a Tea Party guy, and he courted the Christian Civic League and ran far right and won the Republican primary for the second district that way. I don't think he has many core positions, and I think he is very much an opportunist. But I did think it was interesting. He, what you say about avoiding the media, he actually gave his own explanation for that in these remarks. And so we'll put up a piece about this as well, but I can play some tape of it here.
I will tell you, anywhere you go in D.C., whether you're coming out of my office building or going through a tunnel, or going across the street trying to not get mowed down. You think the press is bad in Maine? They are, it's unbelievable. And they are dying to get you on record to say whatever, and that becomes the next. So, I used to think that folks in Congress like me because I'm a big-hearted Frenchman like Norman. I'm a happy guy. And I'm always working hard, knowing exactly where we're going. The reason is because they need our seat. There are 24, that's it, 24 swing districts in the country, 435 members of Congress, 24, 2025. They can go either way. We win them, we're in the majority, we can advance agenda. We lose them, Pelosi, Maxine Waters, Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie Sanders run the show.
Maybe I'll just stop there and say that sounds great.
That's just the reality of the numbers. Okay? So we've got to be incredibly careful. Now, do I talk to the national media? Not often. I've been dying to do what you want me to do. Dying to do it. We've got to be very... It would be stupid for me to engage the national media to give them and everybody else the ammunition they need, and we lose this seat. You've got to be really careful. But I get it.
He is pretty clear that if he spoke his mind to the media, he would lose his seat. And that is just a startling admission to me for any politician.
I think that's interesting. And I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I mean, I think that it is remarkable to me how opportunistic he is. And I think that statement is a good example of he is just 100% discerning what he says when based on his reelection prospects, which is like... Mm. I think of all the qualities that you're looking for in a leader, or that you would say you don't want in a leader. Like, that's probably number one on the list. Like, you definitely want a leader who is willing to weigh in on important issues regardless of their electoral prospects. Right. The thing that I guess I just can't get over the darkness of that position is that it's like it does seem to me to be a little bit more than he's just sticking his finger in the wind. Like, I guess it just sounds to me like when he was saying, oh, I would love to speak my mind. Mm-hmm. I would love to say this. Like, there's one way to hear that where you're hearing he's saying that because he knows that sort of he's got like a pro-Trump audience in front of him and he's trying to like identify with them and like make them think like, oh, I agree with you. Vote for me. I'm one of you. But when you put this whole picture together, I do feel like there is this voice I'm hearing in how he's speaking where he actually genuinely does want to go and say that he supports the president and these crazy right. things. Like, I don't think it's that far-fetched to say that – yes, he has this history of kind of flip-flopping all of this stuff and like running on technocratic stuff. But I don't know, just at the end of the day, you like get these behind the scenes shots of him
right.
trying to like really act like a true believer. And it's like, I don't know, maybe at some point we do need to take this guy at his word that he really does want to get up there and say that he supports these racist policies of the president.
Well, I think he definitely has an economic agenda that he is stuck to, cutting taxes for big corporations and the wealthy. And, you know, that's what he's done on the finance committee and defended Wall Street firms. It's obviously his personal history, being a millionaire from Wall Street. So I think there is some, yeah, I think you're right that there is some, you know, policy core there and very well could include these kind of racist measures as well. But I don't think we'll solve today the exact mix of craven and evil that come together for Representative Poliquin.
Opportunism versus evil. That can be a new, like ignorance versus evil. This is a Poliquin question. Opportunism or evil?
Exactly. He's a unique case. So on that that low note from our representative, let's try and go up a little higher here and get to some rays of hope. Do you have a positive bit of information or feeling that you'd like to share with folks?
I thought we would be remiss if we did not talk about the rally against white supremacy that happened in Portland on Sunday. Folks from all over the state gathered to, you know, in the wake of Charlottesville, say that this kind of thing is not acceptable, and just making the statement in Maine, being around so many people in this massive crowd in this park in Portland. And Deka, who is just this amazing woman who they're representing the Somali Community Association of Maine and then also the Maine Immigrant Rights Coalition, you know, gets up and makes this statement that I am a Black Muslim immigrant woman and I am not going anywhere. And this entire crowd of people was on its feet, roaring applause. And there was just something about that moment for me. I mean, it really moved me almost to tears. I don't know how else to describe it except the exact opposite of the feeling I'd had that whole week watching the coverage of Charlottesville, where you just feel like demoralized and like almost powerless. And being with that many people echoing that level of determination and just resolute commitment to like exist and to be here and to persist. It was incredibly moving, incredibly healing, and it just, I don't know, it's been with me this whole week.
Wow, that's really great. I'm sorry I wasn't there for that. The pictures and the videos just looked amazing from the march and from the rally. We should say on another event coming up, Resistance Rising, a forum with candidates and potential candidates for high office in Maine, is coming to Lewiston on Wednesday, August 30th at 5:30 p.m. You can find the details on our Facebook page. And that is another great event I hope we get a lot of people out for and cover some of these issues and get some candidates on the right page to potentially replace people like Governor LePage and Representative Pollock. My ray of hope, I will stick actually with the CD2 theme. And there are lots of good candidates that have come out as potential opponents to Representative Poliquin. Some of them personal friends of mine, Tim Rich, Jonathan Fulford. Another one came out today, Representative Jared Golden, the assistant majority leader in the Maine House. And we've talked about him before on the podcast, but he had a very strong launch today. And my favorite part of it is that in his ad, his video that he put up explaining himself and why he wants to run against Representative Poliquin, he used clips from the video from Beacon of Poliquin refusing to answer seniors' questions and then running out the door of the retirement home there. So I figured at some point, you know, once we put that up on YouTube, that some candidate would use that in an ad. I didn't think it would happen so early, and it was great to see. And I feel like, you know, we'll definitely see how this primary works out here, but definitely Poliquin and his folks seem to be scared of Jared Golden. They were already attacking him on Twitter, calling him young Jared Golden. Seems to be the Trump-like moniker or epithet that they have ascribed to him. Let me just say one thing about that, since we're talking about history here, is he is 34, I believe, and that is 3 years older than Bill Cohen was and 4 years older than Olympia Snow was when they both won that seat. So I'm not sure that an age attack is going to work the best on him.
Right. Yeah, I will also say again, just free advice to the Republican Party as we dole out here in our way to our massive conservative audience.
Well, we do know the Republican Party listens, so
that's true. That's true. So, you know, please feel free to use this in a memo, and you can cite me or not. In a time of populism, when you're trying to cash in on, like, I don't know, this sort of politics of resentment that it seems like very intent that like everybody from the White House on down is trying to do. Being young is definitely seen as being on the side of change. And in my experience, knowing a little bit about this personally, older voters actually in particular are very attracted to the idea of another generation stepping up and taking charge. And Poliquin's biggest liability is going to be that he's going to be seen as part of the swamp, right? You know? And I don't know, playing right into Jared's hand around like setting him up as this young guy that's going to be, you know, I don't know, like very
indifferent. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just a dumb move. So I don't know. Like, I think if I were Jared, I'd be very happy that that's how they're tagging him this early.
All right. Some free advice. All right. So thanks, Ben. I feel like this is a really good conversation. I think we'll have to talk more about Maine history and what we're going to do about positive monuments in this state. Thanks to everyone for listening. We'd love your thoughts as well. You can give us a call at 619-3182. Thank you to our sponsor this week, Dr. Bronner's. Dr. Bronner's is a family-owned business committed to making socially and environmentally responsible products of the highest quality. They dedicate their profits to help make a better world. Find their organic and fair trade products across Maine wherever natural products are sold. Thank you also to all 32,000 members of the Maine People's Alliance. You can follow us on Twitter at MEBeacon. And our theme music is courtesy of Civil War hero Joshua Chamberlain.
You know who we are, what we're doing here, but if you're going to fight alongside us, there's a few things I want you to know. This regiment was formed last summer in Maine. There were 1,000 of us then. There are less than 300 of us now. All of us volunteered to fight for the Union, just as you did. Some came mainly because we were bored at home. Thought this looked like it might be fun. Some came because we were ashamed not to. Many of us came because it was the right thing to do. And all of us have seen men die. This is a different kind of army. If you look back through history, you will see men fighting for pay, for women, for some other kind of loot. They fight for land, power. Because a king leads them, or just because they like killing. But we are here for something new. This has not happened much in the history of the world. We are an army out to set other men free. America should be free ground. All of it. Not divided by a line between slave state and free. All the way. From here to the Pacific Ocean. No man has to bow. No man born to royalty. Here we judge you by what you do, not by who your father was. Here you can be something. Here is the place to build a home. But it's not the land. There's always more land. It's the idea that we all have value. You and me. What we're fighting for, in the end, fighting for each other. Sorry, I didn't mean to preach.